Adieu. Adieu. Chapter 1. An Old Monastery. Come, deputy of the center, forward. Quick step. March. If we want to be in time to dine with the others. Jump, Marquis. There, that's right. Why, you can skip across a stubble field like a deer. These words were said by a huntsman peacefully seated at the edge of the forest of Isle Adam, who was finishing a Havana cigar while waiting for his companion, who had lost his way in the tangled underbrush of the wood. At his side, four panting dogs were watching, as he did, the personage he addressed. To understand how sarcastic were these exhortations, repeated at intervals, we should state that the approaching huntsman was a stout little man whose protuberant stomach was the evidence of a truly ministerial and bone point. He was struggling painfully across the furrows of a vast wheat field recently harvested, the stubble of which considerably impeded him, while to add to his other miseries the sun's rays, striking obliquely on his face, collected an abundance of drops of perspiration. Absorbed in the effort to maintain his equilibrium, he leaned, now forward, now back, in close imitation of the pitching of a carriage when violently jolted. The weather looked threatening. Though several spaces of blue sky still parted the thick black clouds toward the horizon, a flock of fleecy vapors were advancing with great rapidity and drawing a light gray curtain from east to west. As the wind was acting only on the upper region of the air, the atmosphere below it pressed down the hot vapors of the earth. Surrounded by masses of tall trees, the valley through which the hunter struggled felt like a furnace. Parched and silent, the forest seemed thirsty. The birds, even the insects, were voiceless, the treetops scarcely waved. Those persons who may still remember the summer of 1819 can imagine the woes of the poor deputy, who was struggling along, drenched in sweat, to regain his mocking friend. The latter, while smoking his cigar, had calculated from the position of the sun that it must be about 5 in the afternoon. "Where the devil are we?" said the stout huntsman, mopping his forehead and leaning against the trunk of a tree nearly opposite to his companion, for he felt unequal to the effort of leaping the ditch between them. "That's for me to ask you," said the other, laughing, as he lay among the tall brown brake which crowned the bank. Then, throwing the end of his cigar into the ditch, he cried out vehemently, "I swear by St. Hubert that never again will I trust myself in unknown territory with a statesman, though he be, like you, my dear Dalbin, a college mate." "But, Philippe, have you forgotten your French? Or have you left your wits in Siberia?" replied the stout man, casting a sorrowfully comic look at a signpost about 100 feet away. "True, true," cried Philippe, seizing his gun and springing with a bound into the field and thence to the post. "This way, Dalbin, this way," he called back to his friend, pointing to a broad paved path and reading aloud the sign, "From Baye to Isle Adam. We shall certainly find the path to Casson, which must branch from this one between here and Isle Adam." "You are right, Colonel," said Monsieur Dalbin, replacing upon his head the cap with which he had been fanning himself. "Forward then, my respectable privy councillor," replied Colonel Philippe, whistling to the dogs, who seemed more willing to obey him than the public functionary to whom they belonged. "Are you aware, Marquis," said the jeering soldier, "that we still have 6 miles to go? That village over there must be Baye." "Good heavens!" cried the Marquis, "go to Casson if you must, but you'll go alone. I prefer to stay here, in spite of the coming storm, and wait for the horse you can send me from the chateau. You've played me a trick, Susie. We were to have had a nice little hunt not far from Casson, and beaten the covers I know. Instead of that, you have kept me running like a hare since 4 o'clock this morning, and all I've had for breakfast is a cup of milk. Now, if you ever have a petition before the court, I'll make you lose it, however just your claim." The poor discouraged huntsman sat down on a stone that supported the signpost, relieved himself of his gun and his game bag, and heaved a long sigh. "France! Such are thy deputies!" exclaimed Colonel de Sucy, laughing. "Ah! My poor Dalbin, if you had been like me 6 years in the wilds of Siberia!" He said no more, but he raised his eyes to heaven as if that anguish were between himself and God. "Come, march on," he added. "If you sit still you are lost." "How can I, Philippe? It is an old magisterial habit to sit still. On my honor. I'm tired out, if I had only killed a hare." The two men presented a rather rare contrast. The public functionary was 42 years of age and seemed no more than 30, whereas the soldier was 30, and seemed 40 at the least. Both wore the red rosette of the officers of the Legion of Honor. A few spare locks of black hair mixed with white, like the wing of a magpie, escaped from the colonel's cap, while handsome brown curls adorned the brow of the statesman. One was tall, gallant, high-strung, and the lines of his pallid face showed terrible passions or frightful griefs. The other had a face that was brilliant with health, and jovially worth of an Epicurean. Both were deeply sunburned, and their high gaiters of tanned leather showed signs of the bogs and the thickets they had just come through. "Come," said Monsieur de Sucy, "let us get on. A short hour's march, and we shall reach Kassan in time for a good dinner." "It is easy to see you have never loved," replied the counselor, with a look that was pitifully comic. "You are as relentless as Article 304 of the Penal Code." Philippe de Sucy quivered, his broad brow contracted, his face became as somber as the skies above them. Some memory of awful bitterness distorted for a moment his features, but he said nothing. Like all strong men, he drove down his emotions to the depths of his heart, thinking perhaps, as simple characters are apt to think, that there was something immodest in unveiling griefs when human language cannot render their depths and may only rouse the mockery of those who do not comprehend them. Monsieur d'Albin had one of those delicate natures which divine sorrows, and are instantly sympathetic to the emotion they have involuntarily aroused. He respected his friend's silence, rose, forgot his fatigue, and followed him silently, grieved to have touched a wound that was evidently not healed. "Some day, my friend," said Philippe, pressing his hand, and thanking him for his mute repentance by a heart-rending look, "I will relate to you my life. Today I cannot." They continued their way in silence. When the colonel's pain seemed soothed, the marquis resumed his fatigue, and with the instinct, or rather the will, of a wearied man his eye took in the very depths of the forest, he questioned the treetops and examined the branching paths, hoping to discover some dwelling where he could ask hospitality. Arriving at a crossways, he thought he noticed a slight smoke rising among the trees. He stopped, looked more attentively, and saw, in the midst of a vast copse, the dark green branches of several pine trees. "A house! A house!" he cried, with the joy the sailor feels in crying land. Then he sprang quickly into the copse, and the colonel, who had fallen into a deep reverie, followed him mechanically. "I'd rather get an omelette, some cottage bread, and a chair here," he said, "than go to Kassan for sofas, truffles, and Bordeaux." These words were an exclamation of enthusiasm, elicited from the counselor on catching sight of a wall, the white towers of which glimmered in the distance through the brown masses of the tree trunks. "Ha! Ha! This looks to me as if it had once been a priory," cried the marquis, as they reached a very old and blackened gate, through which they could see, in the midst of a large park, a building constructed in the style of the monasteries of old. How those rascals the monks knew how to choose their sites! This last exclamation was an expression of surprise and pleasure at the poetical hermitage which met his eyes. The house stood on the slope of the mountain, at the summit of which is the village of Nerville. The great centennial oaks of the forest which encircled the dwelling made the place an absolute solitude. The main building, formerly occupied by the monks, faced south. The park seemed to have about 40 acres. Near the house lay a succession of green meadows, charmingly crossed by several clear rivulets, with here and there a piece of water naturally placed without the least apparent artifice. Trees of elegant shape and varied foliage were distributed about. Grottoes, cleverly managed, and massive terraces with dilapidated steps and rusty railings, gave a peculiar character to this lone retreat. Art had harmonized her constructions with the picturesque effects of nature. Human passion seemed to die at the feet of those great trees, which guarded this asylum from the tumult of the world as they shaded it from the fires of the sun. "How desolate!" thought Monsieur d'Albin, observing the somber expression which the ancient building gave to the landscape, gloomy as though a curse were on it. It seemed a fatal spot deserted by man. Ivy had stretched its tortuous muscles, covered by its rich green mantle, everywhere. Brown or green, red or yellow mosses and lichens spread their romantic tints on trees and seats and roofs and stones. The crumbling window casings were hollowed by rain, defaced by time, the balconies were broken, the terraces demolished. Some of the outside shutters hung from a single hinge. The rotten doors seemed quite unable to resist an assailant. Covered with shining tufts of mistletoe, the branches of the neglected fruit trees gave no sign of fruit. Grass grew in the paths. Such ruin and desolation cast a weird poesy on the scene, filling the souls of the spectators with dreamy thoughts. A poet would have stood there long, plunged in a melancholy reverie, admiring this disorder so full of harmony, this destruction which was not without its grace. Suddenly, the brown tiles shone, the mosses glittered, fantastic shadows danced upon the meadows and beneath the trees, fading colors revived, striking contrasts developed, the foliage of the trees and shrubs defined itself more clearly in the light. Then, the light went out. The landscape seemed to have spoken, and now was silent, returning to its gloom, or rather to the soft sad tones of an autumnal twilight. "It is the palace of the Sleeping Beauty," said the Marquis, beginning to view the house with the eyes of a landowner. "I wonder to whom it belongs. He must be a stupid fellow not to live in such an exquisite spot." At that instant a woman sprang from beneath a chestnut tree standing to the right of the gate, and, without making any noise, passed before the Marquis as rapidly as the shadow of a cloud. This vision made him mute with surprise. "Why, Albin, what's the matter?" asked the Colonel. "I am rubbing my eyes to know if I am asleep or awake," replied the Marquis, with his face close to the iron rails as he tried to get another sight of the phantom. "She must be beneath that fig tree," he said, pointing to the foliage of a tree which rose above the wall to the left of the gate.
"She? Who?
How can I tell?" replied Monsieur d'Albin. "A strange woman rose up there, just before me," he said in a low voice. "She seemed to come from the world of shades rather than from the land of the living. She is so slender, so light, so filmy, she must be diaphanous. Her face was as white as milk, her eyes, her clothes, her hair jet black. She looked at me as she flitted by, and though I may say I'm no coward, that cold immovable look froze the blood in my veins."
"Is she pretty?" asked Philippe.
"I don't know. I could see nothing but the eyes in that face."
"Well, let the dinner at Cassan go to the devil," cried the Colonel.
"Suppose we stay here. I have a sudden childish desire to enter that singular house. Do you see those window frames painted red, and the red lines on the doors and shutters? Doesn't the place look to you as if it belonged to the devil? Perhaps he inherited it from the monks. Come, let us pursue the black and white lady, forward, march," cried Philippe, with forced gaiety. At that instant the two huntsmen heard a cry that was something like that of a mouse caught in a trap. They listened. The rustle of a few shrubs sounded in the silence like the murmur of a breaking wave. In vain they listened for other sounds, the earth was dumb, and kept the secret of those light steps, if, indeed, the unknown woman moved at all.
"It is very singular," said Philippe.